Let us turn to the Word of God in the book of Genesis and take as our text chapter 49 and verse 18. Chapter 49 and verse 18 of the book of Genesis. In the NIV, it reads as follows: I look for your deliverance, O Lord. I look for your deliverance, O Lord. In the Authorized Version, it reads in this way: I have waited for thy salvation, O Lord. I have waited for thy salvation, O Lord. I'm sure that when problems crowd upon you in the course of your life, as problems do, and very often they come in crowds and not singly, then you have this desire, oh, that I might have the key to life, that I might have a simple key that would unlock all my problems and set me free. Well, this is the key. In this 18th verse, I look for your deliverance, O Lord. And you may say, well, that doesn't seem to be a key that delivers me immediately. No, that is true. But nevertheless, this is the key. I look for your deliverance, O Lord. Because in that verse, you see two things very clearly. First of all, that you and I cannot deliver ourselves. We have come to the end of our tether, and we are looking to somebody else. I look towards another person, and that other person is the Lord. But he is able to deliver, and in his own time, he does and will deliver. I look for your deliverance, O Lord. But you may say, oh, I want another kind of deliverance. I want to be set free from my problems today. And you can struggle and strain yourself, but deliverance will not come in that way. God intends to develop within you a particular character, and that is a character which expresses the humility of waiting for God's deliverance. And since our struggle is primarily against the sin of pride, which is the sin of all men and women, then sometimes we may be kept a very long time to experience the Lord's delivery, because he wishes to deal with something that is far more basic than our problem, and that is our pride, and that is our lack of patience. And we are told, look for deliverance. It will come. It will not delay. In God's time it will come. I look for your deliverance, O Lord. Now this is what Jacob had learnt. Now there was a time, of course, when Jacob had depended on his own scheming to get the things that he wanted. And he had depended upon his own ingenuity and upon his own initiative. But these had brought him more trouble than they had brought success. Let me remind you of what we've been studying in the book of Genesis in regards to Jacob. To remember him as a young man, he knew that God had promised before his birth that he would be the leader in that family and that he would inherit the spiritual blessings. This was his birthright. But you remember that his older brother, by an hour or two, namely the brother, or less than that, Esau, he was the one who officially had the birthright. And instead of waiting for God, I have waited for you. No, he hadn't at that time. Instead of waiting for God to give him this blessing, he tried to engineer the blessing by persuading his brother to give him the birthright. You remember the incident? His brother was very hungry coming in from hunting, and Jacob was preparing some food, and the brother said, give me some of that soup. And his answer was, I will not give you any until you sell me your birthright. Well, he got the birthright given to him, but he earned the animosity of his brother. So his own ingenuity brought him more trouble than success. Later on, when his father Isaac thought he was dying, he wished to pronounce a blessing upon Esau. And Jacob said, now I want that blessing. And you remember how he disguised himself as his brother because his father was blind, and how he did succeed in getting the father to prophesy this blessing upon him. But again, he earned his brother's hatred and his brother's determination to murder him. The result was that Jacob had to escape and spent 20 years in exile. Well, even at that stage, when he first left home under such terrible conditions, God mercifully met with him at Bethel and promised him many great blessings. And he was really surprised and ashamed and said, God is in this place and I didn't know it. But even so, even though God showed, look here, you wait for me, you trust in me, even so, he continued for the next 20 years very much in the same attitude of mind. And when he came to his place of exile with his uncle Laban in the land of Haran, there he sought a wife, and again he went about things without any prayer. And we find that he himself was deceived, landed himself in no end of problems and troubles, and for 20 years he had to learn that doing your own thing is not God's way. God's way is to teach you and me to wait for him, to look unto him, to pray unto him, to take the stance of faith in him. Well, eventually, you remember that Jacob began to think of returning home, and God commanded him to do so. And then when he was coming home, he heard that his brother was coming to meet him with 400 soldiers, and he was in a panic. And you remember how he prayed all night at this place called Peniel. And it's there that God really taught him that if you wait for me and trust in me, I will bless you. And it is there that Jacob obtained this new name of Israel, which means a prince in the sight of God. It is there that he looked to God for salvation and looked to God for reconciliation with his brother Esau. You remember the narrative that when his brother met him, they were reconciled and were friends from that time onwards. So it is this God-given deliverance that Jacob experienced on that occasion. And it is this God-given deliverance that he looks for in relation to his sons. Here the old man of 147 years of age is dying, and he is prophesying what is going to happen to his sons and their descendants and the tribes that will come from them. And he is giving warnings and he is giving promises. And this is what he's looking for. I look for your deliverance, O Lord. I have had your salvation. You see, in the original language, something can be translated as the past tense and also with a present connotation and a future connotation as well. I have waited for thy salvation. He has proved God. I have waited. And now I am still looking. And I will continue to look for your salvation, not only for myself, but for my sons and their descendants. And it's in that way that he approaches this whole question. Now we take up at the account in verse 16 of the remaining six sons. We saw the prophecies of Jacob regarding the first six sons last week. We continue from that point, bearing as our key this statement, I look for your deliverance, O Lord. Now, in verse 16, he refers to his son Dan. And he says two things about Dan. He says that Dan has the ability to administer. You see, he knows his sons. He's observed them over many years. And he can see this ability to administer, to sum up a situation, and to come to a just conclusion. Dan will provide justice for his people as one of the tribes of Israel. And you can imagine in the future years, during the 400 years after Jacob died, when these tribes were slaves in Egypt, when they were servants in Egypt, how they kept their hope by reading and rereading these prophecies that their father had given. As the descendants of Dan read these, they would say to themselves, now we are not going to stay in Egypt forever. We are going to conquer the land of Canaan. We will occupy a certain amount of territory. And we as a tribe will provide justice for our people. So there was a promise of a future there. But Dan was also a very cunning man. And this can be for good and it can be for evil. A person who has a quick grasp of the situation and knows how to use the situation properly. But of course, this can turn out into a very deceptive characteristic. And therefore, there is a warning implied in Jacob's prophecy with regards to Dan. He is really telling Dan, don't trust in your own sense of administration. Don't trust in your own ability to sum up the situation. Don't trust in your own cunning. I look for your deliverance, O Lord. That's what you should be doing, Dan. There's the warning. Dan will be a serpent by the roadside, a viper along the path. And the word used here is for a particular snake that was pale yellow in color and which lay in the yellowish dust on the road. So it couldn't be seen. And it could immediately dart out and give a fatal bite to a horse's heel or to a human heel. And so there is the warning. You have the ability to administer justice. You have the ability also to sum up the situation and to use it. But that can turn for your own destruction if you become more serpent-like than you should. And of course, this was the history of Dan, unfortunately. It became the tribe that established idolatry in the north of the land after the conquest of Canaan centuries later. A very remarkable prophecy this was. But there is a warning there that you and I should look for deliverance unto God. Then he moves on to the next son, the son Gad, mentioned in the 19th verse. He says, Gad will be attacked by a band of raiders, but he will attack them at their heels. Now, when it came to the division of the territory in the days of Moses, the latter life of Moses, and the life of Joshua, the tribe of Gad occupied a very vulnerable position on the eastern side of the River Jordan, where it was open to attack by the Moabites and the Ammonites, and also people across the eastern desert, and also from the northern trade routes. A territory that would constantly and always be under attack. But Jacob has noticed that in Gad there is a great ability to persevere, a great ability to have dogged perseverance. Gad will be attacked by a band of raiders, but he will attack them at their heels. He will not give up. And very frequently, in the days of King David and those that followed, there are constant references to men from Gad who made up a proportion of the army of the king of Israel. Well, now then again, the suggestion is, don't depend upon your own ability to persevere. Look to God. Look to God. Your perseverance is God-given. Give God the glory. Trust in the Lord, not in your own ability. Then he moves on to the next son, Asher, in verse 20. And he speaks of Asher, whose food will be rich. He will provide delicacies fit for a king. Again, centuries later, when this tribe occupied its territory in the land of Canaan, it occupied the northwestern section along the coast from Mount Carmel right up towards in the direction of Tyre and Sidon. A coastal flatland that was very fruitful, very fertile. But there was the danger. Asher was going to have material success. Asher was going to be filled with food and with plenty. And there's the warning that success can bring danger of complacency and satisfaction. And the key is, I look for your deliverance, O Lord. Don't allow the successes in life to take your eyes off God. Do not allow prosperity in life to make you self-sufficient and self-satisfied. Then he proceeds to refer to Naphtali And you notice that among many of these sons of Jacob, we have no information whatsoever apart from what we are reading at the moment. They do not stand out in the history of Jacob and his family, with only an occasional reference to these tribes in the later histories of the Bible. But Naphtali is described as a doe, as a deer. And you know that a deer is frequently the inhabitant of the mountains. Naphtali is a doe set free that bears beautiful fawns. That's a better translation than the Authorized Version, which says he giveth goodly words. The picture, rather, is of a deer that is free and free to live its own life, untrammeled and unhindered, able to produce its young and to bring them up in the freedom of the highlands. It is the highland freedom. It is the freedom of the mountaineer. It is the freedom of the man who dwells in the mountains, in the inaccessible areas. And this was the region that the tribe of Naphtali later occupied in the days of Joshua. It was the mountain regions in the north of Galilee that became the portion of Naphtali. And in those mountain fastnesses, it was most difficult to overcome this tribe. So therefore, being untrammeled, being unfettered, being free, there was the danger of them becoming independent. And the warning is given. I look for your deliverance, O Lord. Do not trust in your own freedom. Do not trust in your own independence. Do not become independent of God. Don't become unrestrained, but let your life be a God-centered one. And then coming to Benjamin in verse 27, this youngest son of his, he says, Benjamin is a ravenous wolf. In the morning he devours the prey, in the evening he divides the plunder. What's he referring to? He's referring to his strength, that this youngest son was particularly strong. People wouldn't attack him with impunity. He is one that always succeeds. He is militarily strong. And the tribe of Benjamin did become reckoned as a militarily power. And on one occasion, this tribe of Benjamin, in a civil war, fought all the remaining tribes of the land of Israel. And there is the warning that you do not depend upon your own military power. Do not become self-confident. Do not be proud, but rather look for deliverance from God. Well, coming back to the one that we've just passed by in verse 22, namely Joseph. The words of Jacob in relation to Joseph, his favorite son, are longer and more thorough than his words against any of the other sons. He speaks, first of all, of Joseph's present fruitfulness, of his past adversity, and of his future blessing. He begins with a reference to Joseph's present success. Joseph is a fruitful vine. There's the description of Joseph as the man in charge of Egypt, next in importance to the king, to the Pharaoh. We've seen in our study of this book how Joseph came to that position. It was God's doing. And Joseph is a man who has obtained the key to life like his father did. Joseph is a man who has used this key. Joseph is a man whose life has been God-centered. And he knows that his success is attributed unto God. And Joseph is a person whose success has not gone to his head. He has been a humble person. He has been obedient and faithful unto God throughout his life since his early days when he was converted as a young teenager. Joseph is a fruitful vine. You get the picture of a vine growing near a well and its branches going over the wall and the grapes hanging over the wall. Here is a fruitful vine near a spring whose branches climb over a wall. There you see his present status, and it is a God-given status. But of course, Joseph had been tried and proved. because you will remember the incident of how his brothers became jealous of him, how they contemplated murdering him, how they sold him to the Ishmaelites, and they sold him as a slave in Egypt, and how for a long time he served as a slave, and eventually was wrongly accused and maligned and unjustly put in prison, where he remained for a number of years. During all that time, his faith had been tried. But you remember the statement that was repeated frequently, and God was with Joseph. And Joseph knew that God was with him. And throughout those long years, when it seemed that nothing was working out for his benefit, he clung to God and really took up this attitude that his father had. I look for your deliverance, O Lord. And you remember the deliverance came most unexpectedly and in a most unusual way when he was called upon to interpret the dreams of the Pharaoh. And through God giving him that interpretation, he so amazed and astounded the Pharaoh that he was appointed to be in charge of the whole land of Egypt. You remember how he prophesied that there would be famine after a time of prosperity. Well, here you see then, Joseph has learnt to trust in God through adversity. And this is what is described here in the verses 23 and 24. With bitterness, archers attacked him. You remember what I said last week, that these prophecies are written in poetic form, and therefore the words are full of imagery. It is a series of comparisons. You don't have words that are to be literally interpreted. With bitterness, archers attacked him. Of course, he wasn't attacked by archers, but it is the poetic way of speaking of the pressure that was upon him as he felt that problems were crowding upon him, like arrows being fired at you, relentlessly, showers of arrows. So Joseph had had his brothers against him. So Joseph had been a slave in Egypt. And Joseph had been wrongly accused by Potiphar's wife. And Joseph had been placed in prison. It was the arrows that were coming upon him, the opposition, the adversity, but his attitude of looking unto God for salvation had really been proved correct. With bitterness, archers attacked him. They shot at him with hostility, but his bow remained steady. His strong arm stayed supple. Why? Because God was with him. Now look at the description of God in these verses. There are several titles given to God here. First of all, how did Joseph succeed throughout that time of adversity? Because of the hand of the mighty one of Jacob, the God of his father, the mighty God, the power of God is emphasized here. The God whom his father had experienced now became the God that Joseph experienced. He entered into his father's experience. He was able to say, I don't believe in God simply because my father tells me. I believe in God because I've proved God. The mighty one of my father, his hand is upon me. And then he describes God as the shepherd. Now he'd been brought up as a shepherd. He knew what it was to be a shepherd. A shepherd in those days didn't turn his sheep into a field and lock the gate and go home to have his supper. The shepherd lived with the sheep. There were no fields that were enclosed as we have today. The sheep were out on the hills. There were no dry stone walls to keep them within an enclosure. The sheep wandered over the hills, and you had to be with them. And the grass was sparse, and you had to be looking for fresh grass. And you'd have to call the sheep, and they would know your voice. And you'd have to be looking for water. And then when it came at night time, you would have to drive them into a small pen. And you'd have to sit in the gap to be the door. And you would be the protector against the lion and the bear and the wolf. So the shepherd is the one who is protector. Now Joseph has experienced God as his protector. I have been in adversity, says Joseph, because of the shepherd. God the shepherd has cared for me. And this is what Jacob refers to when he pronounces this blessing upon his son. You are one that God has made into a fruitful vine. You are one whom God has shepherded. You are one who has experienced the mighty one of your father, even the living God. Then he describes God as the rock of Israel. The rock of Israel, speaking, of course, of the unwavering strength of God. The rock that will not be shattered. The rock that is dependable. The rock of ages that will continue from generation to generation. This is what it means to look for deliverance from God. You're looking for deliverance from the shepherd. You're looking for deliverance from the mighty one. You're looking for deliverance from the rock, the one that is steady and immovable. He is your father's God. And the word used here is El, which speaks of the creator. You're depending upon the one who created the universe. Look upon the stars. He is the one who created them. Look upon the oceans. He created them. Look upon the earth. Look through a magnifying glass. Look through a microscope. Look at the details in this creation. It is the creator. It is God. This is the one that you are turning to when you say, I look for your deliverance, O Lord. Because of your father's God who helps you, because of the Almighty, this is the word Shaddai, and we've come across this word before, and it speaks of salvation. It speaks of the God of creation who is the God of salvation. He is the one who saves you, El Shaddai, the God Almighty who blesses you with the blessings of the heavens above, blessings of the deep that lies below, blessings of the breast and womb. Do you see how Jacob expands in this description of the mighty blessings of God? It's not one blessing that you inherit when you look unto God. You may go through a difficult time and you may say, well, where is God? And you're called upon to hold on to him and to cling to his promise, because he will bring you into this large place of abundant blessings. Wait for it. Wait for it. And then he speaks of the future. He says, your father's blessings, he says, are greater than the blessings of the ancient mountains. Though here I would think that the authorized version is superior, where it says that your father's blessings are greater than those of his progenitors. The blessings of thy father have prevailed. The blessings of thy father have prevailed above the blessings of my progenitors and to the utmost bound of the everlasting hills. You've got the picture of blessings like a flood, and the flood is rising up to the top of the everlasting hills. And Jacob says, Abram was blessed, my grandfather. Isaac, my father, was blessed. But the blessings that God has given me have risen up to the tops of the everlasting hills, and these are the blessings that will be upon Joseph. And that's the prophecy. And you remember when we looked at the previous chapter, when Jacob adopted the two sons of Joseph and referred to them, Ephraim and Manasseh, that they will be the most powerful tribes in the future. And of course, that's exactly what happened. It was Ephraim and Manasseh that were the largest and the strongest tribes and straddled across the central portion of the land of Canaan and across the River Jordan into Transjordan. They were the major tribes in that central and eastern section. Well, here then, he says, these blessings that your father experienced, these blessings that are so great, let all these, he says, rest on the head.